Okay, let's make a start for our last session of the afternoon. I'm delighted to introduce Toby Hanfield from Monash, who's going to be speaking to us on evolution and realism about chance. Welcome, Toby.
Thanks, Hugh, and thanks especially for inviting me, since my talk isn't really on causation. But as you would have noticed maybe from John's Nowstairs talks, there are clear areas of overlap or interrelatedness between causation and chance, and I will indirectly be saying something about causation during this talk. But given that you didn't come along to this workshop expecting to hear a talk about chance, I might just give a slightly longer than usual preamble explaining what my topic is and make sure you're all on the same page. By chances, I'm not talking just about probabilities more generally. I'm talking about some special sort of subspecies of probability, something like an objective probabilistic fact. And there's a significant and ongoing philosophical controversy about whether there are any such things. Why might you think that there are such things to start with? Well, let's begin. Why might you be skeptical? You might think that if I ask someone, is Woolloomooloo the suburb next to Potts Point? And they reply, I'm pretty sure. Okay. They seem to be expressing an attitude which you might describe as, well, they personally ascribe a high probability to the truth of that statement. But we don't seem to need any further objective probabilistic fact about that. We just need it to either be true or false that Woolloomooloo is the suburb next to Potts Point. The probabilities seem to come into the picture as a way of describing the peculiar state of mind of the person whose opinion you've just asked. But not all probabilities seem to be that sort, where you need them only to describe the state of mind of individual believers and individual epistemic circumstances. If I am concerned about the possibility that, having studied a bit of the molecular theory of gases, I realize that, gee, all the oxygen molecules could land over the seats and there'd be none in the area of the lectern and I would asphyxiate. And I turn to a physicist for advice, shouldn't I be worried about this? If a physicist says, no, that has extremely low probability, they're not saying, oh, don't worry about it, I'm confident it won't happen. They're saying more than that. They're saying there's some sort of objective fact about how extremely unlikely that is to happen. And that's a good example of a chance fact that they seem to be citing. They're saying it's got a low chance that all the oxygen molecules will migrate to the wrong end of the room for my purposes. We also see chances in other examples that I think Alistair mentioned, in gambling games. Okay, we commonly speak about chances. Now, some philosophical theories cast into doubt whether those are chances truly so called, but intuitively these seem to be quite mind-independent probabilities. You don't use them to describe the states of mind of individuals, you use them to describe the nature of poker, or the nature of coin tossing, and so on. Now, associated with chance, there are peculiar epistemic practices and normative practices. You are, to be someone who has proper rational beliefs about chances, you are guided by some distinctive norms. And what I want to talk about is trying to vindicate those norms, or trying to understand, is there really a basis for them, and sort of come at the whole issue about the metaphysics of chance, is chance real or not, through that normative side. And to give a slightly novel take on that debate, which there's many existing twists and turns in it, I want to do it largely just by analogy. I want to look at a putative debunking of normative facts that's got reasonable support. I happen to believe it, but I'm not going to try and defend it, and that's the debunking of moral norms through evolutionary theory. I think, for reasons largely like those defended by Richard Joyce, that if you tell an evolutionary story about why moral facts seem to exist, you come to the conclusion that there are no moral facts. So strictly understood, there's moral seeming phenomena, there's moral beliefs, but you don't need any further moral facts. I'm going to roughly, very quickly and dirtily present Joyce's kind of story about the evolution of morality and explain why I think it's debunking, but without really hoping to defend and convince you all of that, because lots of people don't accept it. But I then want to try and draw some analogies with, could you do a similar debunking of chance and the peculiar normative phenomena associated with chance in a way analogous with that evolutionary debunking of morality. Okay. So, moving on to section two. What is the evolutionary challenge to moral concepts? Well, first, let me just say some things to define the subject matter. What is it that I'm talking about? I take it that moral judgments have three key features for our purposes. One is that they're action guiding, that is that they're normative, right? If I judge that hitting people is wrong, I take that to provide me with a reason not to engage in hitting people. It guides the way I act. Secondly, and more distinctively about the moral norms seem to be universal. I don't just judge that when I judge that hitting people is wrong, that it's a custom around here or a reason for people around here. I may not think it applies to absolutely everyone. There might be some people who I think are unable to comply with the norm, maybe because they're too young or mentally ill or, and so on. But pretty much everyone should be governed and should find it reason-giving that hitting people is wrong. And thirdly, moral norms seem to have a peculiar force, and this again comes out clearly when you think about them in contrast to others. They seem to be inescapable. So what do I mean by that? Let's think about some other normative systems first. So take the rules of cricket, or tennis, say, was my example. The rules of tennis forbid picking up and moving the net. When I play tennis, normally I take that rule to give me a reason not to pick up and move the net. But I might, in the middle of a tennis game, realize, hey, I could play a great prank on my opponent by lifting up the net in the middle of a rally, so his beautiful shot bounces into the net. Okay? I have broken the rules of tennis. Okay, I have escaped their normative force, it seems. But I don't thereby condemn myself to being irrational. I don't seem to be a fundamentally defective agent just because I broke the rules of tennis. I just decided I didn't want to be governed by those norms anymore. Whereas in the case of moral norms, we think that you can't just opt out that way, or there is at least something seriously defective with you if you opt out by saying, don't feel like playing the morality game today, I'm just going to hit some people for fun. Okay, that would seem to suggest you don't grasp the special force that moral norms have. I mean, various of these features of morality as I've characterised it are contestable. Moral particularists think that not all moral norms are universal. Okay, I'm not sure what I would have to say to all those possible permutations of views about normative ethics that might escape this characterisation. Let's just lock this in as the subject matter of the debunking argument for the sake of that argument. What would it take then to vindicate these norms, to show that their philosophical bona fides are okay? I take it there's two things you could do, and ideally you'd do both of them. One is something like a practical vindication or a pragmatic vindication, and the other is an existential vindication. And here's what I mean by that. Practically, I mean showing somebody that there's a substantive benefit from adhering to this system of norms. Okay. So it would involve, I've got on a handout, involves identifying non-trivial hypothetical imperatives. I mean more than that. I mean justifying some non-trivial hypothetical imperatives of the form, if you want to X, then you ought to do Y. This seems to me the way you would generally vindicate any sort of normative system, such as the rules of tennis, or the laws of New South Wales, or the rules of correct spoken English, right? If you want to do X, then you ought to do Y. So some examples, you might vindicate the rules of cricket by pointing out there's benefits. If you want to prosper at a boys' school in England, you ought to obey the rules of cricket. Or if you want to avoid legal penalty, you ought to obey the law. If you want to be a welcome guest at parties, you ought to adhere to a similar level of etiquette as the other guests. Something like these hypothetical imperatives, if you can justify them, look like they vindicate, in some pragmatic sense, a system of norms. Some vindications, of course, it won't do just to pick any non-trivial hypothetical imperative. It has to be a sufficiently grand one for what we thought the system of norms was for, right? So in a Marxist vein, you might think, oh, his law can only be vindicated by something like If you wish to endorse norms through which the bourgeoisie oppresses the working class and subscribe to a false consciousness, then you ought to obey the law. I take it that's a deflating vindication. Yes, you've found a hypothetical imperative that is justified, but you haven't justified it in as enthusiastic a way as you might have hoped, given your pre-theoretical understanding of what those norms were for, or what that activity, obeying the law, was all about. The second form of vindication would be what I call existential vindication, and this is a much more sort of run-of-the-mill anthropological kind of activity of identifying, well, what really are the norms? What are the rules or the customs or whatever that are supposed to guide our behaviours? So you would take particular judgments in a system of norms and attempt to understand the conditions in which those are true, just fun truth conditions, right? For things like, it is a rule of cricket that a player will be judged leg before wicket in the following circumstances. It is a norm of etiquette around here that it is bad manners to burp while one is eating in the company of others, and so on. So I'm saying existential vindication would be to identify truth conditions for sentences like this and then to go out and do the empirical investigation to confirm those conditions obtain. I take it it's fairly uncontroversial for these non-moral cases, okay, that all you have to do, roughly, is find some sort of community of individuals whose social practices support the norm. Okay. And a classic example from philosophical literature is H.L.A. Hart's concept of law, where he develops quite a sophisticated philosophical anthropology for the sorts of behaviours you require among legal officials in order to have a set of norms that have the distinctive character of laws, as opposed to mere rules of a game or something like that. Okay. We can do that for various different sorts of normative systems. A couple of important features of this activity of doing existential vindication for any normative system: you're going to typically run into indeterminacy about certain normative facts. Take the irritating practice that's growing of saying, I could care less, when the speaker means what we used to mean by I could not care less. Okay? It's growing. I really wish it were incorrect, but it might no longer be a fact, I take it, that it is incorrect, because it's happening so often and so often going uncorrected. Okay? Whenever you have norms undergoing change, there are surely going to be periods of indeterminacy in between where it's not settled one way or the other by the social practices what in fact the norm is, what the normative facts are regarding that. Okay. So there can be widespread indeterminacy, and sometimes we get into arguments about the areas of indeterminacy, but in more reflective vein we kind of realise there's no point arguing about this. At the end of the day, it gets settled by the social facts, by the social practices, and that's really where the foundations for the existence of these norms entirely lies. Just a footnote on that, given I've mentioned Hart. Of course, many of you might know Ronald Dworkin has famously disputed Hart's ideas about the fact that law is settled purely by social practice. Dworkin has said, in effect, that there are existential questions about the existence of law that can be pursued ad infinitum, even in the absence, after total agreement on all the social facts that exist in this in circumstances, that's not a meaningless debate over something that's frankly indeterminate. I mean, to that extent, though, Dworkin is sort of leaning towards the view that law is more like morals than like other normative systems. Okay, which brings me to the moral norms. So, if you have that conception of what it would take to vindicate a set of norms, and I take it that wouldn't be so controversial to go out and vindicate the rules of cricket. For the purpose, if you want to play cricket, then play by these rules. I can establish the existence of the rules of cricket by looking at the practices of cricket players and of umpires and the existence of rule books and things like that. That's all straightforward. Can I do that project successfully, though, vindicating practically and or existentially moral norms? Well, the first problem you hit is it arises from inescapability. As I said, you can't opt out of moral norms. Famously, moral norms give rise not to hypothetical imperatives, but to categorical imperatives. It's not if you want to be moral, you should abstain from hitting people. It's just you should stop abstaining from hitting people End of story. Consequently, in much the same way that I said that Marxist vindication of law looks deflating, it seems to me that any hypothetical imperative you justify with respect to complying with moral norms is going to be deflating. It's not strong enough to vindicate the force that we took the moral norms to have. So it's not to say you might not have prudential and pragmatic reasons for continuing to comply with the moral norms, but those aren't good enough reasons to truly vindicate the moral norms. They're reasons for you, for prudentially, to be moral, but not to vindicate what we took the norms to be saying in the first place. Second, if you try to engage in the somewhat more flat-footed task of just existentially vindicating the moral norms, that turns out to be problematic too. You find that compared to less controversial norms, it's much harder to get agreement on the existence of moral norms, even when participants to a moral debate agree entirely on the social practices that exist. This is in part because of the universality of moral norms. Moral norms do not generally present themselves as merely local customs, such as driving on the left-hand side of the road. Rather, they present themselves as norms which should govern those of us who accept them just as much as those who currently reject them. So, for instance, it's very hard to find uncontroversial truth conditions for sentences like, "It is a universal moral rule that infanticide is always wrong." Many well-informed people insist that sentences like this are true, even though we may point out the lack of social support for such a rule in various places at various times. Others, similarly apprised of the facts, will insist that the contrary is true, that it is a universal moral rule that infanticide is not wrong under certain circumstances. If we were less ambitious, we could seek existential vindication of more local rules. For instance, I imagine we can identify uncontroversial truth conditions for, "It is a widely accepted rule in community X that infanticide is always wrong." And this is consistent with finding the rules universal in scope. That is, we can find that the members of community X take their rule to govern not just their own behaviour but everyone's. But this is not really the sort of existential vindication we're after either. Non-moral norms typically do better because non-moral norms do not present themselves as both universal and inescapable. In the case of cricket, we can vindicate the existence of rules of cricket by looking at the social practice in cricket matches, and there's a nice correspondence between what social behaviours the rules are supposed to govern and where the relevant social behaviours lie. Okay, it's the very same thing, cricket matches, by and large. If we find a community of individuals who seem to reject the rules, then we can simply conclude that they are not playing cricket. But moral rules, understood as universal and inescapable, are underdetermined by any social facts in the domain they are supposed to govern. At best, we get either non-universal rules or an abundance of universal rules which contradict one another. A final, further point can be made about the difficulty in providing an existential vindication of moral norms. Even if there were a universal practice of condemning infanticide, and this is a famous point due to G.E. Moore, it does not seem incoherent for someone to ask, but is infanticide really wrong? It seems then that moral norms are at least not a priori reducible to any pattern of social fact. So given that it's not easy to practically vindicate them because they have this peculiarly strong force, given that it's hard to existentially vindicate them since we take them to be universal and yet what we find is not universal agreement, why do we even believe they exist at all? Why do we believe that there are normative facts? So having run into this sort of difficulty, moving on now to section 2.3, an evolutionary account of moral norms promises to explain why we might have evolved this system of norms that is so difficult to vindicate. What I'm going to present now is a very quick and dirty version of the sort of evolutionary story that has some currency. I haven't done a poll on how plausible, how widely believed this is, but as I say, influenced largely by people like Richard Joyce, it's the sort of picture I find quite plausible. First, we recognise that in our current psychological makeup, there is a tendency to be tempted towards short-term gain at long-term cost. Okay, just think of all standard weakness of will type cases where you try to make a resolution for how you're going to behave in future. It's a good goal for you, that long-term one, but that requires resisting temptation along the way. And typically, when we succumb, we don't just succumb saying, oh yeah, and I'm doing the wrong thing, we typically rationalize our decision and persuade ourselves that it's right. Oh, I could always start jogging tomorrow. That would be just as effective. Okay, today it's so sunny. Oh, next day it's so rainy. Such bad weather for jogging, and so on. We're very, very good at coming up with excuses and rationalizing. And that's no doubt an extremely adaptive feature we've got, this ability to do very flexible means-end reasoning. But it seems here that it can be overly flexible. So think of this as the background condition in which a capacity for moral thought and judgment might turn out to be adaptive. This is kind of like a design weakness we need to overcome. Second, it's especially important for the success of cooperative endeavors with other humans that we be able to engage in long-term commitment to collective goals and in the process abstain from seeking short-term individual goods. In operating a business with a partner, to take an anachronistic example, there may be innumerable opportunities to take the assets of the business and run off to a foreign land for a wild time of gambling and debauchery. To some, this might be very tempting, but the benefits of a business partnership will never be open to you at all unless you can gain the trust of your partner that you'll never succumb to such temptation. Given that the benefits of collaborative endeavors with other humans are enormous, overcoming the tendency to short-term gain and rationalization mentioned above is potentially a very beneficial adaptation. Third, having noted these sort of background circumstances, if some agents evolve a heritable mechanism which enables them to effectively eliminate from deliberation, at least for reasonable periods of time, trust-breaking options such as running off with the business assets, then this could be an adaptive mechanism for a couple of reasons. First, it may have direct prudential benefits because it may enable one to participate more often in productive collaboration with others. There may even be benefits for personal enterprises that do not involve collaboration but require fixed pursuit of a goal for a long period of time. It might enable us to go jogging more often or something, though I'm not saying that that's actually the relevant mechanism for that. Second, it may have group selection effects if groups with this trait are able to outcompete other groups without it, and that's, of course, one of those notoriously controversial debates in evolutionary theory. The suggestion, then, is that the ability to make moral judgments and to develop sets of moral norms is the mechanism in humans which has enabled us to obtain the fitness advantage of reliably entering into trusting collaborative arrangements. What's important about this sort of story is that it tends to support why there should be that peculiar unconditional character about moral norms. Because moral reasoning has evolved to overcome an existing design weakness, namely that our rationalization abilities are so good we can talk ourselves into pretty much anything, we need the moral judgments to have a certain inescapability if they are to be effective. We thus get an explanation of why we have a system of categorical imperatives without getting a practical vindication, or at best, we get a deflated vindication. It turns out that for many of us, much of the time, being moral is useful. Or, more precisely, it turns out that for many of our ancestors, most of the time, the capacity for moral judgments was useful. And moreover, that utility that I mentioned then when I say it was useful is not even the sort necessarily that we really care about, utility for us, it's utility for our genes, some sort of fitness advantage. So at best, an evolutionary account gives us a deflated vindication of moral norms, and moreover, I think it gives us reason to be pessimistic that you'll find any better vindication. Because this is quite a good-looking naturalistic explanation of why this odd-looking system of norms should exist in the first place, then any further weird Platonist story you can tell about the independent moral facts that we're tracking just looks redundant now. Why did you need to posit that extra stuff, given I've got an adequate, naturalistically acceptable explanation? Okay. So that's the story regarding moral norms. That's the reason why I think we should be pessimistic that you can vindicate moral norms. Let's now turn to chance, where I want to try to draw some analogies and see how comparable is the case of trying to vindicate our idea of chance. Firstly, what are the relevant norms regarding chance? Well, think about a gambler who seems to be behaving irrationally. He keeps on, probably the very fact that he's in a casino might be evidence that he's irrational, but he keeps betting on 17 and keeps telling you, I'm sure 17 is going to come up. Now, there could be a couple of reasons why he has this view. One could be, you say, don't you think the roulette wheel that is being spun is fairly constructed? It's symmetrical and so on? Yes. So don't you think the chance of any number is equal? He would say, yes. Still, there haven't been any 17s for so long, I'm sure there's going to be a 17 very soon. This person seems to be defying the norm known as the principal principle, which is that you should make your degrees of confidence match your beliefs about the chances. This gambler believes that the chance of 17 is just the same as any other number, but his degree of confidence is disproportionate that 17 will come up. Another thing he might have said, though, is he might say, no, I actually think this is a rigged wheel. I think there's a chance of 1 in 3 that it will come up 17 on any spin. Now, this seems irrational, though, because you point out, but hang on, it's only been coming up 17 approximately 1 in every 37 spins. Why do you think 17 has such a high chance? And what he's doing there is he's defying the second norm I've got here, which is that you should adopt beliefs about the chances that, other things being equal, maximise the likelihood of your evidence. I mean, it's absurdly unlikely if the wheel's rigged so that 17 has a 1 in 3 chance, it's absurdly unlikely that over a long run of spins, you would only get a frequency of about 1 in 37. It's a much more probable hypothesis that the likelihood of your evidence is much more probable if you suppose the hypothesis that, in fact, the chance of 17 is 1 in 37. So these are the two key norms, I take it, that govern our beliefs about chances. In addition to these normative facts, there are sort of extra conceptual features of our idea about chance. First is that chances are somehow objective, that even agents in very different epistemic circumstances should be aiming to converge on the same chance facts. It's not appropriate that there be sort of irresolvable disagreement about what the chances are, provided people end up ultimately being acquainted with the same evidence. And the last one is perhaps a bit more philosophically controversial, but I think is fairly straightforwardly part of our folk concept of chance, and that is that you can be hugely unlucky. Okay? That the famous Rosencrantz and Guildenstern scene in which they flip a coin, I think it's just from the film rather than ever from being actually in Hamlet, where they flip a coin for a very, very long time and it just keeps on coming up heads, that's possible even when it's a fair coin. You can have a frequency of heads that's 100%, even maybe in an infinitely long trial, even though the chance of heads is 0.5. That's really unlucky, but possible. And if you buy into this thought that the evidence can, the frequency, well, that we can be very unlucky in the mismatch between frequencies and chances, then it seems you are committed to something like an irreducibility of chance to frequencies. Now, many of you will know about various philosophical projects that have attempted to, in sophisticated ways, such as David Lewis's way, to identify chances with frequencies, but I think that's clearly a departure from the folk concept. So I just want to start out with the intuitive folk concept that it is possible to have infinitely long runs of bad luck. Okay. Now, to vindicate the chance norms, in a practical sense, we would need to identify, in the same vein as before, a suitably non-trivial hypothetical imperative of the form, if you want to do X, then you ought to follow the chance norms. First, the good news. This does not look like such a hopeless task as it did with the moral norms. We can probably come up with a very general goal, such as having a high number of true beliefs, or being successful in trying to achieve one's goals, which, and these sorts of goals do seem to be served by following the chance norms, and if you then justified, therefore, a hypothetical imperative making reference to that goal, it seems to me non-deflating. It seems to me a perfectly good vindication of the chance norms. So I suggest something like Proposition 3 as our target here. This is what we're going to try to justify. If you want to achieve your goals, then you ought to follow the chance norms. Compared to trying to vindicate moral norms that have that peculiar categorical character, this seems much more doable. Doesn't seem like there's an obvious in-principle objection to that. Now for the less good news. In trying to provide a rationale that justifies 3, it is extremely hard not to end up presupposing something about chance and the chance norms. Consequently, it looks like we will at best achieve a somewhat circular vindication. To see this, reflect on the fact that a conditional like 3 does not describe a surefire recipe for success. It is only probably true that, if you match your credences to the chances, you will be successful. So there are going to be some people who are successful, and yet who do not match their credences to their beliefs about the chances. Moreover, and more seriously, there may be people who are unsuccessful despite matching their credences to their beliefs about the chances. Admittedly, much the same sort of thing could have been said about our attempt to vindicate the non-moral norms in a practical sense. It's not true for everyone that, if you want to be a popular guest at parties, you should match your level of etiquette to that of the other guests. For some, it will be a better strategy to be deliberately outrageous and to flout the rules of etiquette. For others, despite their best efforts to conform, they will remain unpopular. So the hypothetical imperatives we cited before are surely only rules of thumb rather than promises of surefire connections between compliance and success. So perhaps it is too demanding to ask for a surefire hypothetical imperative. On the other hand, if we do not demand a conditional that gives a strict formula for success, there is a clear danger of circularity. We don't want, in justifying the imperative, to be presupposing something like, there is a high chance that you will succeed in achieving your goals if you comply with the chance norms. Why should I care about there being a high chance unless I'm already subscribing to the chance norms? Now, circularity of this sort might be unavoidable. I suspect that probabilistic notions infect so much of our thinking that a vindication of chance norms will have to use at least some probabilistic ideas. Whether they're chance ideas, I'm not sure. And I don't think this is necessarily fatal. The circularity could somehow be a virtuous one. But I find it very hard to be confident of my opinions about this matter. It gets very murky very fast. So I just suggest we put this aside. And it's noted as a difficulty about vindicating the chance norms, but let's move on. What about existential vindication? Here we run into a problem that is extremely similar to that which beset the existential vindication of morals. Recall that even where people agree on the social practices in place, there can be disagreement about what the moral norms really are. It may be uncontroversial what the norms are believed to be in a particular community, but because the norms are believed to be universal, it is not possible to identify such merely local norms as genuinely the moral norms. Similarly with chances, even if we are agreed on the frequencies, this does not settle what the chances themselves are because of the irreducibility of chance. Moreover, it turns out that the second norm of chance, the one that says adopt chance hypotheses that maximise the likelihood of the evidence, is itself quite permissive. There are many rationally permissible ways of responding to the evidence so as to adopt chance hypotheses which make the evidence more likely. So even if we sought agreement on what we should believe about the chances given a large pool of shared evidence, that agreement may be unachievable. So we're getting bogged down, in effect, right? We're not getting any new purchase on the vindication the way we've considered it so far. I don't claim to have shown the vindication of chances unequivocally failed. Moreover, there is reason to think that practical vindication will be easier for chance than it is for morals. But that said, it's hard to get an independent handle on why chance norms are practically beneficial, because any attempt to state precisely the way in which they benefit us tends to mention chance. What I suggest we do then to move forward is turn to a similarly biological perspective. I'm not so confident here that it's an evolutionary perspective, because I know much less about the natural history of the concept of chance. It could well be a purely cultural innovation to have explicitly chancy ideas as opposed to merely probabilistic ideas. But still, trying to think about it from that viewpoint of what might the role be for a biological organism to have this sort of chance psychology. So first, before trying to say anything empirical about this, there's a part of the paper that I'm just going to rapidly fly by where I characterise formally what do we think is involved in being a chance believer. And it's basically an expounding of the framework of Bayesian epistemology, which I'm sure will be very familiar to some and extremely unfamiliar to others. The basic idea here is that various people working in a broadly subjectivist tradition of probability theory have developed rigorous formal models for what it is to comply with those chance norms, basically. But these models are entirely subjective. They just describe the psychological state of someone who is acting like they believe in chances and someone who is trying to adopt chance hypotheses that maximize the likelihood of the evidence and someone who's trying to make their degrees of confidence match their favored hypotheses about the chances. Okay, that's all that the Bayesian project, largely due to De Finetti, gives us. Consequently, that formal account on its own can't really advance us any further in the vindication of chance. Because if it was to vindicate us for practically speaking, then we would have to be able to tell some story about, well, why does having that particular psychology lead to success? And you need to mention something about the world to identify whether or not you're succeeding. You can't merely mention internal psychological states. Moreover, to vindicate the existence of chance, it's not going to get us any further, because all this does is characterize what it is to be someone who believes that the world is chancy. It doesn't actually tell you what it is to believe truly that the world is chancy. So the formal Bayesian approach doesn't really get us any further. Just one technical idea that's going to be useful, though, that I want you to have in mind from this approach. What is it that distinguishes our attitude to evidence when we are entertaining chance hypotheses as opposed to other sorts of matters, like that question I raised at the beginning about is Woolloomooloo the suburb next to Potts Point or something else? Well, let's start with a case where intuitively it is a matter of chance. You used to tell me you flipped a coin 10 times and it came up heads 5 times out of 10, and you ask, what do you think the chance is of heads on this coin? It would be odd if I said, well, what did you get last flip? Was the last one you did a head or a tail? And this is part of the distinctive attitude we seem to have to when we're entertaining chance hypotheses, is we don't care about the sequence in which the data was collected, we just care about the frequencies. Being told that 5 out of 10 were heads is enough, I can now pretty comfortably draw a conclusion, yep, the chance is 0.5. And this attitude to evidence has been characterized formally by De Finetti as an attitude of exchangeability over trials. I treat the various trials and their results as exchangeable, doesn't matter what sequence they come in. If it was 5 heads followed by 5 tails, that has exactly the same impact on my epistemic state as head, tail, head, tail, head, tail, and so on. Compare with another case, you tell me, my child has had a fever for 5 out of the last 10 days. What do you think the chances are that, or what's the probability that this child will have a fever tomorrow? It's obviously relevant to say, well, does the child have a fever today? Has the child had fever 5 days running? Or has it been on, off, on, off? Okay? I don't adopt the attitude that each day is an exchangeable trial for having a fever. I'm acutely sensitive to the sequence in which the data has come in, and that's because I don't take it that each day is an independent chance trial for getting a fever, in the same way that each toss of a coin is an independent trial for getting heads or tails. Okay. That's just one bit of formal apparatus that's nice to get out of that subjectivist formal characterization of chance psychology. Going on, though, now to section 3.4, which I must apologize for, is rampantly speculative. I don't really know much about our actual chance psychology, and I don't know how much psychologists actually have to tell us about this. I hope maybe I can learn something about this in question time. But let me dive in anyway. So in the preceding section, I described a commonly used formal model for understanding rational psychology regarding probabilities and chance in particular. Although I cannot hope to give a general account of how, in fact, as a matter of psychological fact, we do engage in cognition about probabilities, there are some empirical results in this area which I think are suggestive, and I'd like to remind you of them if you don't know them already. First, many non-human animals seem to engage in behaviour that resembles adopting a chance hypothesis. I do not know if there's in fact good evidence that animals treat the data as exchangeable, if they have that distinctive attitude where they don't care what sequence the data comes in. Okay. But animals do, for instance, you have a Skinner box, you stick a pigeon in it, 2 levers, lever A and lever B. Lever A has an 80% probability of a food pellet, lever B has a 20% probability of a food pellet. After not very long, the pigeon only pecks lever A. Okay. This is the maximizing strategy if it's a matter of chance. And those are the chances, 0.8 and 0.2, associated with the two levers. Okay? So in some sense, the pigeon seems to be cottoning on to the chances and responding appropriately. Okay? If a rational human were convinced that success in this lever-pressing scenario were a matter of success, or were a matter of chance, and that these were the probabilities, this is the sort of behaviour the human would engage in too. But as it happens, many humans are outperformed by rats and pigeons in experiments like this. What humans tend to do is they tend to operate lever A about 80% of the time. This is after they've had a while to learn what's going on here. They keep thinking there's a pattern, and so they want to keep doing it. And so the pattern seems to reward you some of the time on lever B and some of the time on lever A. And well, maybe they go for this ratio that matches actually the chances. So they operate lever A about 80% of the time, lever B about 20% of the time. And this, they get less food from the same number of trials than a pigeon or a rat put in this scenario. And people persist in doing this for a really long time, too. I don't know if anyone's done it long enough to see how you extinguish this behaviour, but I'm aware of studies that have done 450 trials and people are still pressing in that ratio that's non-optimal. Clearly, the human subjects in this sort of experiment are not treating the sequences of data as exchangeable. Okay? They are looking for probabilistic dependencies between trials and thus treat different sequences of lever pullings and successes as having different epistemic bearing on what they should do. I take it that this is some sort of causal reasoning that humans are engaged in. And of course, causal reasoning is often hugely rewarding. That sort of reasoning is what enables us to engage in and succeed at all sorts of sophisticated behaviours, such as building fires, growing crops, raising animals, and playing poker. This type of reasoning is part of why we outperform rats and pigeons at so many other cognitive tasks. But in an artificially simple case such as this, in which the two levers have fixed chances of success, we reveal a potential cost of our cognitive sophistication. Indeed, other studies have suggested that our persistent seeking for causal explanations of features of the world positively blinds us to some ways in which the world is chancy or random. And this is no doubt a large part of the reason why we entertain superstitious beliefs. Okay. To take one favourite example, Langer and Roth, in a 1975 study, asked undergraduates at Yale to predict the results of 30 coin tosses. Now, the results were then, in fact, manipulated so that everyone in the study got precisely 50% correct and 50% wrong, exactly what you'd expect, given that coin tosses are a matter of chance. But it was manipulated so that some were in a condition whereby they had an early streak of success, you know, 5 out of 5 correct or something at the beginning, and then but it's still compensated by the end, so they still only had 15 out of 30 correct by the end. Among all these students, 1/4 reported afterwards that if they were to do it again, they thought their performance would be hampered by getting distracted. Unless they're imagining distractions so great that they forget to say heads or tails, it's hard to imagine what their causal hypothesis is that could explain that, right? Worse, 40% said their performance would improve with practice. Okay. And finally, among those who had the early streaks of success, they rated themselves as better at coin guessing than average, okay? Even though their result was 15 out of 30, precisely average. In light of this, here are my wild speculations about the psychology of chance in humans and something about the natural history of that and how it compares with the formal model described above. So the formal, hastily skimmed over above, the formal ideas in the Bayesian tradition about updating our beliefs by conditionalization, which is basically the idea of adopting hypotheses that make the data more likely, that's completely general. Roughly, that comes down to the second of those chance norms. That really should govern our probabilistic beliefs, whether they're chance beliefs or not. Okay, that's a very general chance norm. Chance hypotheses are a special case of that more general apparatus of updating by conditionalization. And the generality is something that comes up because a supposition here is that you should be kind of open to every possible probabilistic hypothesis that might explain your data, okay? Which is, of course, a huge, ridiculous idealization. Of course, we're not actually open to every possible probabilistic hypothesis. And evidently, we are open to more than the rats and pigeons. The rats and pigeons pretty quickly hone in on The chance hypotheses, the quite simple ones, whereas we're busy looking for these complicated patterns to explain the particular sequence of successes and failures we've had on past trials. So what's going on in the less cognitively sophisticated animals? I suggest that animals, the non-human animals, have a very much more limited hypothesis space upon which they are engaged in following that second chance norm or probabilistic norm more generally. Relatively simple chance hypotheses, hypotheses that involve treating the data as exchangeable, are cheap to include in one space of hypotheses. They're easy to entertain. You don't need complicated psychology to entertain them. You just need this distinctive attitude of ignoring certain sorts of data, ignoring the sequence that the data comes in. And they're relatively easy to confirm and disconfirm. So something like these simple chance hypotheses presumably play a big role in the probabilistic psychology of pigeons and rats. In contrast, humans have developed the ability to contemplate much more complicated hypotheses, many of which are not chance hypotheses, but are deterministic causal hypotheses encompassing a huge range of variables. This is tremendously useful much of the time because we so often identify what appear to be real causal relations between things that enable us to better manipulate the results for our desired ends, but we're so strongly inclined to engage in causal hypothesizing that we sometimes posit causal relationships to explain what is in fact mere random noise. We are prone to superstitious or ad hoc theorizing. So I suggest we can distinguish two aspects of our chance psychology. First, there's just the relatively primordial aspect. That's the updating by conditionalization. It's the second chance norm. It's adopt probabilistic beliefs that increase the likelihood of the data. And that's the bit that we share with simpler organisms. Second, there's the more explicit conceptual aspect of chance. And this is what brings in the other three ideas, the notions of objectivity and irreducibility, and the normative requirement that we make our degrees of confidence conform to the chances. I mean, I don't think you get that principle-principle type requirement that you need to match your degree of confidence to your belief about the chances until you have this further sophistication of thinking over and above my personal degree of confidence, there is this further thing, the objective chance fact. It doesn't make sense to have that norm until you have that extra sophistication. These ideas, I suggest, are all part of what we might call the sophistication of chance. The treating of chance as a distinct sort of fact or phenomenon that explains frequencies, rather than treating chance hypotheses as merely subjectively optimal strategies to deal with our inability to explain and predict as well as we would like. This, combined with the observation about our propensity to perform badly against rats and pigeons in some cases, suggests a hypothesis about the role of the chance concept, thus sophisticated. Why did we end up acquiring this? Part of the function of this concept, I suggest, is to quell the urge to seek further explanations. As we've already noted, sometimes it's maladaptive to seek further explanations. And having developed an aspect of our psychology, that's the causal reasoning part, that so doggedly and persistently looks for further factors to explain deterministically what's going on, there's a benefit in positing an objective causal explanation cancelling feature of the world. And that's roughly what our notion of objective chance is. Quit looking for any further dependencies, just stop there. That's kind of what it announces to us. Okay. Apologies for running on a bit, getting to the last bit. Section 3.5 now, the vindication of chance. In the case of moral concepts, having run into difficulty with the project of vindication, the turn to evolutionary theory supplied an explanation of why moral norms might exist and why they might possess the peculiar character that distinguishes them from other norms. It ended up giving us a vindication, but a deflating one. Having put forward an admittedly very sketchy account of the natural history of our chance psychology, are we better placed to address the vindication of chance? I think we get the following sort of practical vindication of chance. Proposition 4. For our ancestors, both human and non-human, for a reasonable variety of circumstances they encountered, it was adaptive to engage in probabilistic reasoning. This seems obviously plausible, but all it does is vindicate the most basic probabilistic norm, that second one of the four features of chance I mentioned, that is, adopt probabilistic beliefs that increase the likelihood of your data. If we attempt to vindicate the more elaborate, sophisticated concept, that's my main concern, we can perhaps speculate something like 5, for our human ancestors who had already acquired the ability to engage in causal reasoning, it was in some circumstances adaptive to posit a sophisticated chance concept so as to discourage further seeking of causal explanations. This has a nice parallel with the vindication given of moral judgments, right? Remember I suggested that part of the role of moral judgments is to stop rationalising. You're overusing that faculty, and that's preventing you from entering into long-term collaborative relationships with others. Well, similarly here, maybe the function of chance is stop seeking causal explanations. The world is just beyond your ken at this point. You should get by with your probabilistic beliefs. That's some sort of vindication of having this chance idea. It's somewhat useful, okay? But it has a bit of a ring of deflationism to it, it seems, but I won't push the issue of, as a practical vindication, how adequate that is. Certainly I don't plan to abandon all my chance beliefs in light of my conclusions here. But what about existential vindication? Should we believe there are, in fact, chance facts? I think this leads to a pretty strong prima facie case for anti-realism about chance. Okay. If chance psychology turns out to be useful simply when there is an absence of useful correlations elsewhere in the environment, why think that this is evidence of some further chance fact that is allegedly irreducible to any facts about frequencies? If my biological speculation is right, that the three features of our chance concept that seem to sophisticate chance have developed not to track some independent feature of reality that we could just as well track without chance concepts, but have developed to discourage us from using more high-tech cognitive apparatus, the causal reasoning apparatus, in contexts where it would be fruitless. I think this should greatly lower our confidence in the reliability, then, of our chance concepts. Now, I mean, one obvious move here is you could say, well, I'll retreat to a reductionist realism, and I have much less to say against that today. I find it a less attractive position, but clearly you could just drop the tenet I suggested about chance, that it's irreducible to frequencies, and things might look a lot more viable here. Okay. But now, just to conclude, in many philosophical discussions about chance, realism of some sort is assumed as a default position. Science tells us there are chances, so obviously they are real, something like that. In ethics, on the other hand, I take it that anti-realism is accorded much more respect. The main point I want to make today is that the two cases are much less different than is usually supposed. Yes, in the case of morals, I think the case for anti-realism is particularly strong because of the inescapable character of the norms, but in many other ways there are some striking parallels. Thanks very much. I'm aware that if this argument works, it clearly has the potential for lots of generalisation, and I just haven't done a lot of thinking through the various particular cases and how much it might generalise. But I'm pretty optimistic, at least about more rudimentary areas of mathematics, where I'm inclined to think that there is a feature of the world that, I don't know, two eggs are more nutritious to eat than one, that there is some sort of mathematical fact tangled up in that, which I might be tracking with my mathematical faculties. So I would have thought that my mathematical beliefs are going to come through reasonably intact. Now, of course, it's the more abstruse areas of mathematics that are so far removed from experience. I don't know quite what to say about that. But I would have thought for straightforward number theory and arithmetic, maybe I'll be okay, and there's no direct undermining threat here. I can tell an evolutionary story about how my perceptual faculties of colour evolved. And it turns out that, look, it's not absolutely indispensable to that account that there be a simple property, redness, that that is not further analysed or anything. It turns out that I can dispense with that and understand redness as a somewhat odd collection of wavelength facts and the like. I take that to be a very minimal deflation of red, and we should be quite happy to believe that red really exists and our perceptual faculties reliably track facts about colour. They're not quite as they're presented to us in experience, but I'm not going to be an anti-realist about colour, and so on for lots of other perceptual things. I just think that chance facts are peculiarly much more sophisticated than many other features of our epistemic life.
So I think this is really interesting, but I'm trying to think how it fits with what we know about developmentally. And one thing that's interesting, this is just an observation that we've made, is there's some pretty strong evidence that kids are deterministic to begin with, and when they certainly prefer a kind of subjective probable, a subjective interpretation when things are indeterministic. They tend to look for hidden variables, etc. But an interesting case is the psychological case. So one of the things that we found, for instance, is if we give kids a situation where you say, she goes on the diving board 3 times, but she doesn't go on the diving board 1 time, and you ask them to explain that in terms of, you know, her personality traits, or the, give some causal explanation, they're very likely to say, well, she just didn't want to go that 1 time. And if you sort of think about the psychological case, the causal explanation stops here about the indeterminacy of our actions, especially if you've sort of got a conception of free will that's involved in it too. And the kids, by the time they're 4 or 5, are saying things like, well, there's no, you know, she just didn't want to. That was the reason why she didn't that time, as opposed to in the physical case where they're likely to give explanations. And I suspect that culturally this might be true too, that, you know, some of the very first examples of people using chance are to do oracles or to do, you treat I Ching as if it's telling you, giving you a message from the gods, and I think to this day part of the reason why gamblers gamble is because there's a sense of grace about the fact that you're lucky or the fact that you're not lucky. So there might be I'm sympathetic to the general account, but there might be something particularly interesting about the way that we think about chance in other people's behavior as a kind of bridge between the subjective piece and then this more sophisticated objective piece that probably doesn't develop. I think that probably is one that is developing culturally rather than developing
So I take it that the first observation about children being instinctively determinists about most stuff does fit the thought that the chance, sophisticated chance concept, is a cultural artifact. I hadn't thought about the issue of indeterminism regarding other agents, and I wonder if that could be some sort of source for the chance hypothesis, or if it's just the two ideas running in parallel. But thank you, I need to learn more about this.
Helen.
I might have just missed something, but what in the case with the pigeons picking at the food source,
the
human beings picking at the food source, why is there a reason why we can't just think of that? I haven't got any anti-micro skills to this, I'm just wondering. That we can't just think of that as, well, what's going on is, look, if I keep on pecking at this roughly 80% of the time, I'm going to get some food. And it works if I keep on pecking. That doesn't seem to be a chance hypothesis. It just seems to be a belief about frequencies.
Okay, so the point is this. Let's say I've given you some experience in the Skinner box, and I say, okay, go for it, Helen, and I put you in hungry, so you want food, and I give you 100 presses, okay? If you press lever A 80 times, lever A 80 times in some complicated sequence, because you're motivated to try to get as much as possible, and lever B 20 times interspersed in the sequence, you are going to get less food than a pigeon who goes in there and just pecks lever A 100 times. Your expected utility is slightly lower. Right, so that's the experiment. Now, I'm not quite understanding what your suggestion is.
I thought that one thing you did was kind of ascribe a chance hypothesis to the pigeons.
Okay.
So I'm wondering why the pigeons have to have a chance hypothesis and not simply, you know, an extrapolation from past
memory. Good. So I certainly have no evidence that they have anything like the sophisticated chance hypothesis. And I don't even know if there's good data to suggest that they strictly have the attitude that's associated with chance hypotheses in the Bayesian tradition, which is treating the trials as exchangeable. So I don't know, if the pigeon has 8 successes and 2 failures, does it behave the same as if it gets 2 failures and 8 successes, or whatever? My hunch is this: they don't treat them as strictly exchangeable, but much more so than we do, right? They're much more indifferent to subtle differences in the sequences that the data might arrive in than we are. Whereas what the humans are clearly doing is they're trying to find a pattern, and that means precisely they are not indifferent between different orders in which they have successes and failures contingent upon different pools. So there is evidence that humans are not engaged in classic chance psychology with regard to levers. And it's a bit more speculative, but I'm suggesting that it seems plausible that the pigeons are at least conforming to the basic idea of treating the evidence the way they would if they had chance hypotheses. But that doesn't mean they have the ideas of objectivity or the idea of irreducibility to frequencies. I absolutely don't think that rats and pigeons have those ideas. Yeah.
Michaelis?
Just following up from this point, and that's the thing that occurred to me. I couldn't see why you wanted to think that this sort of setup had any relevance to discussion of chance when that setup looks to be using frequencies alone and is completely consistent with a fundamental doctrine that the world is deterministic. You can imagine similar situations that real world situations in poker games. What's the next card going to be? Well, the chance is 0 and 1 that the next card's going to be a red heart, right? But that's not what we meant. I mean, this is a point made by Isaac Levi, where our betting rates and our views of what the chances are come apart when we're determinists. And yet, he thinks that just shows that the principle that you have as your first norm, yep, is in general false, and we shouldn't have it. And moreover, thinking about that general case, and I noticed that you later on wanted to rule out the sort of causal story as a chance story, but in fact, the story that you tell in the non-trivial case should generalize to the trivial case, and it's a mark against the theory if it doesn't generalize. So your second principle is also implausible when you think about the more general case, including the trivial case, where you are a determinist and yet still have chances for particular events.
Right. Okay. So I think I disagree with about the second last thing you said, but I think I can agree with almost everything else, and it comes down to, I think, just how I was putting it. So there's sort of a clumsiness in my talk in that I start talking about chance and I characterize it with these 4 aspects, but then I kind of want to separate chance psychology into the really simple bit that pigeons and rats share with us. And that, I agree, is completely compatible with being determinists, as it were, and just saying these are purely subjective probabilities. Because I've started using the word chance, it sort of sounds infelicitous to start calling them any probabilities now. But I want to agree with you that believing that there are no facts about chances is consistent with that part of epistemology, let's say. But then your other points are kind of straying into broader issues about, well, given that, what should we say about this odd thing, chance? And I don't kind of want to be pushing too many barriers in that debate right now about whether or not it's... I'm much more optimistic that if there are going to be chances, that we can uphold all those norms, and I'm not going to say they're just false, but I grant you the compatibility of that determinism thought with the core probabilistic norm. Yeah.
Just a small suggestion about the two norms. So when you talked about the gambler,
yep.
Who thinks that what was number 13 is really likely,
yep.
Well, you think he's very confident that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So one option was, he thinks the wheel's fair, but he's still very confident.
Yeah.
One option was that he thinks 13 has a very high chance, and the problem with that is that it makes his evidence very unlikely. But a third option would be that he thinks the chance is changing from spin to spin. In which case, it could, he's setting his credences to the chances, and he's also his evidence is very likely. It could be, given the way the chances were in previous spins. So maybe,
good.
Maybe there's a third norm,
good.
Something like it stays stable over time, or it's got to do with the physical setup of the wheel, which isn't changing, or
yes.
Something like that. So
there is some sort of platitude in the vicinity that chances supervene on the intrinsic physical setup of something or other. But it's very hard to specify that so precisely that it is obviously irrational to think that the chances are changing on the roulette wheel, because in fact, surely roulette wheels do decay over time and change slightly intrinsically. So maybe we don't have to make it more explicit and say he believes that the setup is physically identical and nonetheless believes that the chances are changing.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be far enough. So thanks.
And you thought there was a magnet under the table that was moving around. Maybe that's a false belief that might not be there.
Yeah, that's not irrational.
Irrational, so.
Yeah,
yeah,
good. Yeah. Thank you, that's a helpful extra platitude about chance.
I've just got a very general comment. I like the story about chance and the way you've set it up in terms of the analogy. But I just wanted to point out that in both the moral case and the chance case, as you set it up, there's another option apart from the taking this to be debunking option, which is basically the option of thinking, well, it only looks debunking if you come to the situation with a particular metaphysical conception of what this bit of language is doing. This could be put in terms of Peter's framework from this morning. So if you come with the conception that the job this language is doing is keeping track of some bit of the external world, then by those standards it looks debunking. But if you don't come with that conception, then and you, as it were, just speak with the folk, nothing in the story prevents you from going on speaking with the folk and going on saying that there are moral norms, there are chances. It's just that the effect of the story is to give you a different understanding. Again, you could put this in terms of Peter's model, a different understanding between, as it were, level one and level two in his model. Well, I suppose the understanding itself would be at level three.
Yep.
And so the point is simply that one feature of this parallel is that the issue as to whether you think of it as debunking does kind of depend on some stuff in the background, which is, roughly speaking, stuff about whether you think of the language as representational or not.
Yes.
Or representational in some sort of substantial sense.
I tend to default to representationalism in my
many
training,
people do,
but
yeah.
Yes. Point conceded.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Yes.
So, just being kind to the human who keeps pressing 20% of the time, it looks like superstition or something. I wonder if the human's just being sort of humane about causation and saying, well, things might change, right? It's been 80% till now, but a lob each way, I'm going to keep pressing this one in case the mechanism changes. Over time, don't know, like, superstitions look stupid. You know, if we put 20% of the wheat harvest into the temple for no obvious reason, whilst there's lots of wheat, it looks stupid until a famine, in which case having 20% put to the side looks to be a nice buffer against things changing.
I don't think that that's an instance of superstition, the human hitting the lever 20% of the time. I just think it's a case where, at the end of the day, they get less food out of this machine than the rat does. And if we had set it up in with some different mechanism whereby there was this elaborate press A four times, followed by one press on B, followed by two presses on A, the human's the one who's going to discover that complicated maximal reward strategy. The pigeon's not going to. I assume pigeons can't work out seven-step sequences, okay? But because the human invests all this time in trying different pattern-seeking behaviours, they've got a much better likelihood of hitting upon such a mechanism if there is one. It's just that it's costly in cases where it turns out there is no mechanism. That's all the point I want to make with that particular example.
It's just that with the pigeon or the seagull, they're going to keep pecking the red dot to get the mother to regurgitate, irrespective of whether the red dot's connected to the mother or not. It's just they're going to keep going for it because they're going to get connected to a stimulus response, whereas humans are a bit more plastic in this building.
Yeah, let's not write off the pigeon's plasticity. If you switch the probabilities so that after 200 trials, lever A only rewards you 20% of the time and lever B rewards you 80% of the time, I imagine pigeons and rats, again, speaking without authority here, will learn. You know, this isn't working so well as it used to. Might try that one, and so on.
I think Alison's going to speak with some authority.
Yeah.
If what you're trying to do is just act in that situation and get the best reward, then maximizing is best. But if you've actually got an epistemic motivation, which is that you want to try and figure out what the likeliest hypothesis is, then there's actually circumstances in which you're better off sampling the other button for some period of time. So if you think, okay, now I've got a probability of 80% that it's A, and I've got a hypothesis that has a probability of 20% that it's B, and what I want to do is sort of get a lot of data that will let me test those hypotheses, as opposed to that I actually want to get the outcome, then in that circumstance, you're actually better off doing the probability matching than you are doing the maximizing. Because, of course, in the maximizing, once you touch it, once you get the reward, you're not ever going to be able to get the other information. There's actually interesting evidence with animals that foraging birds actually will probability match in some circumstances. And it's one of these very elegant evolutionary things where what I gather is, in circumstances where there's an uneven distribution of goods, then you actually do get animals probability matching versus maximizing, because that enables the entire community to get to the unlikely good. So I think there's other arguments, or sort of social arguments, where if you've got the whole community and everybody just goes for the 100%, you have this tree that gives you rewards 100% of the time, has 100% that has better fruit than this other one. If everybody just goes to the one with better fruit, then we'll do worse than if some people some of the time go to the one that has less fruit. So it's actually not that they're acting simply, but they're actually acting quite differently depending on the circumstances. And there are circumstances in which that's actually a good strategy, but it's not one where it's not an issue of attracting objective chance.
No.
Peter.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting story. I guess thinking about it makes you think it provides support for a view in which the truth might be either a very mild error theory or a very mild non-factualism. And it's a very subtle question about the usage and the way people think and talk that we split those two. There's a good paper by Michael Strebbins from some years ago that follows up a tradition that goes back to Poincaré and Reichenbach, which is about inferring probabilities from symmetries. So in the case of things like dice and roulette wheels, you've got physical symmetries that prompt a lot of probabilistic thinking, and they can override frequency information. You know, if the coin comes up ten times heads, when I look at it and I see it's very symmetrical, that will guide probabilistic judgments more than frequency information, like override frequency information, and rationally so in some sense. And people, I forget the technical details of this, but people like Strevens and Reichenbach have tried to get close to a sort of reductive account, but not all the way, because you can't go all the way to a reductive account of probabilities based on symmetries. But one way to sort of, one way to read the overall situation is to say that, right, we're either projecting or wrong when we make claims about objective chance. But the, either the projections we make or the false claims that we make are so closely tied to useful facts about physical symmetries that, you know, we're glad that we're doing it for the most part. No reason to change it very much. And some people, there might be differences between individuals, so some people might really believe that there's a fact of the matter about objective irreducible chances, and error theory is true of them. Other people might be a little bit more the other way. They say, well, it's just something I say and it seems to be doing me some good. More projectivist view is true of them. So there might be a total picture that could be described in which you have a very difficult question about practice and usage, which is a choice between mild error theory and mild projectivism. And you can see very clearly why it's useful for people to engage in a certain amount of this stuff, because of the way it attunes their practical judgments to questions about physical symmetries in objects.
Yes, I'm very sympathetic to all of that. I love the Strevens paper and his more recent work elaborating the same approach, and I think that the way you describe it is exactly right. It shows how there is this extremely useful thing that relates probabilities to symmetries without quite getting you there all the way to chance. I also think, and now you might say, okay, but at the end of the day then basically things are left unruffled. I mean, and I should mention there's some philosophical payoff in the Strevens sort of project, because you then get to go back and take up the cudgel against David Lewis, who thought there were no chances if there was determinism, whereas Strevens shows us a nice way to get quasi-chances or something very, very close there too, even in a strictly deterministic world, which I find quite appealing.
Yes.
Yeah, so kind of following up from that, I just want to say something in defense of realism here. It seems the kind of instrumental sort of explanation of the development of this concept of chance isn't that far off from the kind of vindication that you were arguing in the earlier section was unattainable. So if we're in setups where formulating chance hypotheses is the best thing to do, then isn't that just what it is for there to be chance setups that we're regularly in? So it would be a reductionist kind of realism for sure, but we already had good reason to think that a reductionist kind of realism was the best kind of realism, which are maybe these Lewisian style arguments, the anti-Humean whatnot kind of argument, that a non-reductionist account of chance couldn't be explanatory. So I'm not seeing a real threat to realism.
Well, if you're conceding reducibility straight away, fine, the paper lacks a certain amount of motivation, because I am assuming irreducibility of chance as part of that's what the concept is. And I find the metaphysical debates over the Humean whatnots, although I've ended up agreeing with Lewis and Van Thrassen that sort of metaphysical chances can't explain frequencies, it took me years of, you know, soul searching and difficult argument to be persuaded on of that one way or the other. I don't think it's an easy matter to agree with Lewis on that at all. And I'm surprised to hear this comment coming from you of all people. I thought you were much more gung-ho about the prospects of that kind of realism. Sorry, don't get to derail
it. It doesn't have to be to actual frequency, right? There's a bit of reduction. Yeah.
Didn't you have a question?
Well, I'm sorry, but I should explain that I haven't been around philosophy for about 30 or 40 years.
That's okay, you can still ask the question.
And therefore, I do not, I'm totally out of touch. But I just wanted to ask about probability. Has it been discussed, is this a classical point or not, that it seems, especially when one considers symmetries, and I think it probably always reduces to that when you talk about probability theory, take it far enough, that for some reason, the absence of a reason to prefer this rather than that is a reason not to prefer this rather than that. Almost like a kind of extension of Occam's razor, but somehow much more mysterious thing. Is that something which is, does that make any sense for a start? If I toss a coin, the fact that there is no reason to prefer a round of heads rather than a round of tails becomes a reason not to prefer that, not to expect that.
So is the thought that some sort of principle of sufficient reason, is it, or insufficient reason,
yes,
principle of indifference, is it?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I take it that chance is not reducible to such epistemological symmetry. And it seems that in some of our physical theories, like in quantum mechanics, we find, you know, well, the electron could have spin up or it could have spin down. There seems to be no symmetry-breaking consideration about this, but nonetheless, the probabilities don't have to be equal of spin up or spin down. So that you can, it certainly seems conceivable that there'd be empirical circumstances in which you discover non-equal chances, but no a priori reason to favour one or the other. It's just that's the way the world's turned out, that there are asymmetric chances despite symmetric reasons. So I'm sceptical about the possibility that you can reduce all probability to these symmetry considerations.
Thank you. Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Toby for a fascinating And just a reminder that we start tomorrow earlier. We start first paper is